with that, Melissa's going to come introduce our speaker.
Hi, I'm Melissa Holmes, alcoholic. And I was asked to introduce Barbara, your speaker tonight. I was just thinking, I met Barbara almost 4 years ago, something like that, at her very first AA meeting ever. And it's been my privilege to have worked with her over that time and watched her grow. I mean, she is my example of how you do AA when you first come in, when you're desperate and willing to kind of do anything that's asked. I did not do it her way. I drug my feet the entire time. And so it's been my privilege to kind of be a part of her journey and one of my favorite people on earth. So here's Barbara.
Hey y'all, I'm Barb Begner, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
it's a pleasure to be here. I've only told my hour story like one other time. My sobriety date's July 15th of 2010, so I'm going on about 4 years, and Melissa's very correct. It was my first AA meeting ever when I walked into the doors of the Fifth Tradition, which is my home group, desperate and just falling apart, and I didn't know, like, I was willing to give up all happiness just to not drink anymore. And it turned out to be so much more than that. You know, I've gotten so many blessings since I've come into the rooms of AA. And so, you know, the speaker's job, my job, I guess, is to say what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now, or my search to find the God of my understanding. So that's what I'm going to do for the next little bit here. You know, my childhood was pretty normal. You know, it wasn't, other than the fact that I had pathological fear. I mean, that was like, I was born, you know, I'm going to tell you this one little kind of quirky thing, because I do some quirky stuff, and went to a seminar, and it had regression therapy in it, and it was like, you know, the whole, like a group like this, and the guy said, you know, we're going to take you back into the womb, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm going to be one of those that just falls asleep, and it's not going to, you know, it's not going to do anything, because this is like kind of crazy shit and stuff, sorry. And I will clean it up. It's hard for me to do sometimes. And so anyway, so I'm in, you know, he's talking and you're going back through and then going to the womb and oh my God, I was struck with fear. Just like it came out of nowhere and I was like in tears. I could feel it so strongly. And I started looking back at my childhood and that was kind of how I felt. And I don't know where that came from, but I felt like I was just kind of born that way. And I was afraid of absolutely everything my whole life until I found AA actually and worked my fear inventory. And that's when it started to lift, you know, and that's a long time. I didn't come into these rooms until I was 56 years old. I started drinking when I was 13 and I drank as often as I could. And I ended up being a daily drinker whenever I could, but you know, so my childhood was kind of normal, you know, and then when I was about 13, I guess that's about eighth grade is when I took my first drink, and I don't remember exactly the first drink, but I do kind of think it was a six pack of, God, what was the drinks? It was beer. It was not Falstaff. Maybe it was Falstaff. Or what's the one that had a little more kick to it? I don't know what it was. Colt 45, that was it. Takes somebody about the same decade, you know, to know Colt 45. And I remember being at I don't know if the memory is correct or not, but what I do remember is being at my parents were out of town, I was having a party and I was drinking, and it made me feel semi-normal. You know, it wasn't like one of those, oh my God, this is it experiences, as much as I think I can kind of function now, you know? I mean, like when you're full of fear, it takes a lot to drown it out. And so, but that started at 13, and then honestly for the next forever, like until I came here, that's what I wanted, that was my life. And I didn't realize it though. I was just a party girl, you know? And so, but I made it through school. I went through, at 13, I was in junior high school. And made it through junior high school, and I went to an all-girls Catholic high school, and we were like wild girls. I mean, there was drugs in my story, and there was a lot of drugs back in the 70s, if you know, and so it was like hard to not do them, really. I mean, they were everywhere. So it was even in class, you know, these nuns, we'd drop mescaline and do crazy stuff in the classroom, you know, but It was kind of a fun experience, but I was so afraid of everything and everybody, and I didn't relate to people very well, and I didn't have that many friends. I could maybe have one friend at a time, and that kind of continued until not that long ago. And so high school was, you know, I was born with some brains, so I could still, you know, function and graduate from my high school. But I remember all through high school, I'd say I'm going to the library, and I would be at friend's house getting high and smoke and drinking any chance I could get, you know. And that's the people that I could gravitate to from the very beginning. You know, we're going to be party people. And I pretty much surrounded myself with party people for the rest of my life. I had some little reprieves that I'll talk about. You know, my alcoholism kind of ebbed and flowed a little bit until I got into my 50s and then, or late 40s, and then it was, you know, I absolutely knew I was powerless at that point. But in the beginning, it was just fun, you know, but I always drank to excess. I was always the one throwing up in somebody's bathroom or doing other bodily fluid stuff in closets and stuff, you know. It was like, or desk drawers, you know, if like in the middle of the night, you know, it's like, oh God, it's so embarrassing. But that was kind of my, you know, I wasn't a pretty drinker usually. I didn't get mean so much as just kind of sloppy, you know. So, but it's, back then it was just, it's so normal when you're hanging out with party people that everybody just parties. So high school, made it through high school. Then I got to college, my first year in college, and oh my God, what a mess I was. You know, I never made it to class. I was, oh, this was days where a lot of heroin. And I must say, I never shot it up, but I did do a lot of smoking it and snorting it, and Quaaludes were big, and it was really any kind of drug you could find, and the alcohol, and it was every day. And the drinking age was 18, and I was 17, and I could get into the liquor store and buy, I think it was, I thought it was very classy because it was Blue Nun Liebfer Milk or Boone's Farm apple wine. And I know, ooh, like, but it was great back then, you know. It was, and I just, anytime I could, I drank. So I was so afraid. I mean, I had classes of 300 people. I was petrified to go into a classroom. So I didn't. And I just, everybody was overdosing, and it was just crazy times. And I got a 0.07 average, I think, that first year. I mean, I just didn't really make it. And I came home, my parents allowed me to come home. I'm sure they were very worried about me. Of course, I was totally clueless about that. Could have cared less what they thought. But I slept for about a summer, you know, and then I had kind of a little break for a while. I thought, God, that was kind of scary. I mean, I almost overdosed, and it was, my life was just in ruins, and this wasn't the person that I wanted to be, was this this drug, alcohol-inducing, imbibing individual for the rest of my life. So I kind of pulled it together, went to a community college, and I was working full-time and going to school full-time, and I still could hit the bars at night. And I did that for a couple years, and then I went to university for 4 years. So it took me 7 years to get my first degree. And I did. I got a degree in horticulture in Michigan, and Michigan State. And so I'm a Michigander, as my friend Katie would say. In fact, Katie and I know y'all heard her last week, and our stories are so different, and we're like best of friends. You know, it's amazing what this program can do as far as blending people together. So I ended up here, let's see, was that after Michigan State? I graduated from Michigan State and was here, moved here in 1979, and I thought I'd be here for a couple years. You know, literally, I drew the name out of a hat. Like a friend of mine and I, we put 5 city names in a hat and said, where do we want to move to? And I think Boulder, Colorado. I was living in Colorado at the time, and so it was either Boulder or Key West or Atlanta, or then there were 2 other cities, and we had 5 people pull the names, and 5 out of 6 people pulled Atlanta, said, oh my God, it's fate, you know, we've got to come to Atlanta, you know. So I moved to Atlanta Labor Day weekend of 1979, and, you know, no job, and oh, landed in Little Five Points, and I was I was in heaven. I mean, I stayed there until 1996 when I moved out into my neighborhood, and then that's, the party was back on again, you know. I mean, I was living just to, I was working in a greenhouse at real low wages, and I was oh my God, you know, it was just drinking every day, absolutely. From that point on, I was a daily drinker, except for my two pregnancies, which I actually did quit almost for 9 months with both of those. And, but it was just part of, you know, I'd stop at the liquor store on the way home from the greenhouse, and I'd get my six pack, and I'd pop it, and I'd drink it, and I'd, you know, go home, and then I'd split a 12 pack with my roommate, and then we'd go out at 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and we'd party, and then I did this for, you know, quite a while, from 79 till about 1983. And when I had been living out in Colorado, I had a sister who, the reason I had moved out there from Michigan was she had cancer. And so I went out to kind of be with her, and she had a baby. She found out that she had melanoma. She was a month pregnant, and they found the melanoma. And so I stayed for a year, and I stayed for the birth of the baby. And then I left, and I came back. Well, about a year later, they realized that the melanoma had continued to spread. I thought she was in remission. So from 79 to 83, I was like crazy partying here in Atlanta. And she died in 1983. And then I just was like, I had a real reason to drink and party. And just before that, it's just such a crazy time, you know. It was just going out to the bars and one night stands and just living just to do that. I mean, that was all my life. That's all I wanted to do, was just to get up and I'd have to go to work because I knew I had to pay the bills, and then I couldn't start drinking until 5 o'clock. And I kept that I'm not an alcoholic if I can hold on until 5 o'clock mentality until the end of my drinking. So for the next 30 years, I was like, if I can just wait until 5 o'clock, then there's nothing wrong. I'm not an alcoholic. And I would laugh over the years with friends, you know, oh, you think we're an alcoholic? No, I have my job. I don't drink until 5 o'clock, you know, and I know that those are the things. I've never been arrested. I don't have a DUI. I can't be an alcoholic as long as I'm still functioning. And I believe that really forever until I was so miserable that I started looking at alcoholism a little bit more seriously. So in 83, I was just hitting the bars. There was, you know, it was just a real party scene in Atlanta from those years, 79 to 83. And it was just going out and one night stands and getting drunk and hangovers. And then my sister was dying. And just, I've shared this before with when I've told my story at my home group. And in 83, I had a sexual assault. And I was so drunk that I wasn't really affected that much by it, I didn't think. And about 2 weeks later, the guy tried to rape somebody else, and she fought back, and he killed her. He stabbed her to death, and it freaked me out. And it freaked my sister out. She was pretty much on her deathbed, and she said, you've got to get your act together. You can't be living this lifestyle anymore. And I kind of listened to those words, and at the same time, there was somebody pursuing me, a man in my life that, you know, I didn't do relationships very well. I had sporadic boyfriends here and there, but I don't connect with people very well. I have an occasional girlfriend here, you know, as a friend, and occasional boyfriend, but I emotionally am detached. I don't know how to relate to people. I just don't do that very well. But I had this one man who seemed kind of successful, and he pursued me. And the irony of it is he wasn't a drinker. And I knew back then in the late 70s and early 80s that it would be much better for me if I was with somebody who didn't drink like I did. Because number one, he could drive me everywhere, which he proceeded to do for the next 20-some years. I married him. And, you know, so it was safety. Like it was like I knew I'd be safe and I'd be secure and somebody'd take care of me and he could drive and we wouldn't get into fights from drinking too much. And my sister died, and then my dad died, and I was like going nowhere with my job. So I thought, okay, you know, I'll marry you. So I did I moved in with him in 86. And the 3 years before that, I was a mess with my sister, and I was absolutely at the bars, like heavy every night and just trashed. And I knew I needed to slow down. And at that point, I could control it. Well, I could control it a little bit. You know, a little bit. Like I moved in with him, and I could drink at home, and I wasn't at the bars anymore. And so I wasn't really controlling it then. But then in 88, we got married, and I got pregnant right away. I'm 34 years old. Like, I know better, you know, than to marry somebody that. But it really was all about, I knew my life. I probably would have been dead if I didn't do that. And So I married him and got pregnant right away. And as soon as on April 1st of 88, I took a pregnancy test and I was pregnant and I smoked my last cigarette and I had my last drink. And then I didn't drink for 9 months with him. And during, so that, you know, I was actually, that wasn't hard. I remember that not being hard, which is so amazing because I couldn't do it otherwise. And then once he was born, I slowly started back drinking a little bit. And then I decided, I knew I wasn't in a great place with my marriage. So I planned like my escape route, which was nursing school. So I went to nursing school in 90. And I had another son during that time. So I had a couple periods in there from like 88 until 93 of relative normal drinking. You know, I would drink at home at night. I would party with my friends on the weekends, like binge kind of. But, and I was a party person, but it wasn't out of control. And I don't remember having hangovers every day. And I wasn't sick all the time. And I wasn't always throwing up in somebody's car and doing all that stuff. So I graduated from nursing school in 93, and I started working in a hospital, and my kids were, you know, getting a little bit bigger, and just slowly over time, it just started creeping back in, and that couple glasses of wine that I would have every night, because I was still a daily drinker. I couldn't not drink every day. I couldn't imagine life without drinks at 5 o'clock. My parents did it. They had two, and I had a little more than that, especially towards the end, but I couldn't imagine life without alcohol every day. And I didn't know that I had the obsession back then. I had to have it. I had it planned. I always had it in my house. I wouldn't go to restaurants that didn't have it. As my kids were growing up, I couldn't go weekend trips because I couldn't drink. And I thought all that was just kind of normal. I didn't realize that was my disease. That was way back then. It just took me a long time to feel the pain enough to want to come in here. And so slowly just started. So the two glasses of wine that I would have, the bottle, because I was drinking wine back then, and I'd have a couple glasses, and then it would be more than that, and then there would be that much left in the bottle. I'd go, well, I might as well just finish the whole bottle. So I did that like every night, but it was just me because my husband didn't drink, and so I would drink and then fall asleep or pass out at like 8 o'clock every night, and that's what I did like throughout most of my child rearing days. But I functioned. I was working as a nurse. I didn't start having really bad hangovers. And that's kind of how I judge when my drinking escalated, was probably about 3 years into my nursing career. So about 96 or something, I think, is when it really started to build up again. And we moved during that time from in town. So I got out of the little Five Points Candler Park area and moved into where I am now in the Northlake vicinity. So I just, you know, I'd have my bottle of wine every night, and then I'd have two or three on the weekends when I party with my friends, and I functioned. You know, I went to work, and I'd go to a friend's house on Friday night, and I'd have to work on Saturday morning, and at 7 a.m, I'd have to be in the emergency room. And I would say, I'm gonna go have just one drink, because I'm working tomorrow. I'd find myself there every time at 2 a.m, last person to leave the party, and in 3 hours, 4 hours, I'd have to get up and go to work, and I'd be so hungover, and these poor patients, thank God I didn't kill anybody, because I could smell the alcohol coming off of me, and I did that for a long time. And I still didn't realize that was alcoholism. I just thought I liked to party, you know, that's what I do. So I continued to do that through, that whole time. And then my sons were getting older, and I took a trip to Europe with one of them. He was in a youth orchestra, and we went over to Europe, and it was a lot of fun. But I felt a lot of freedom. Like, I was away from my husband, and I was unhappily married for a long time, but I was determined to stay in that marriage. And I used to think I had to drink to be married to him, and I realized that's not true, you know. But I realized he probably did save my life, you know, but it was only through working the steps that happened. And so in about 2000, that was my life for, you know, that was just that. It was drinking and partying and hangovers and working and raising my kids, and it was busy, and I wasn't happy, and I was still full of fear, but I did the best I could with what I had. So I, in, 2006, I got a little taste of freedom, And I thought, oh my God, I know what the answer is to my happiness. I'm going to get divorced because this is really what I've wanted all the time. And I thought, this is, my life's going to be great now, you know. So it took us, it was nasty divorce because I was, oh my God. My personality had changed when it came to him and drinking. You know, I'm the one who wanted the divorce. I didn't love the man. I was so angry. And my kids got all wrapped up in that, and I'd be yelling at them, and I was drunk. But I thought my life is going to be great now. You know, I'm the freedom. My kids will be gone. My husband's going to be gone. I can live how I want. And so that worked for a short period of time. It seemed like it was fun. It seemed like that's what I wanted to do. And then I realized, oh my God, I am. The alcohol consumption was off the charts. I mean, I didn't start blacking out until that last 2 years of my drinking. I mean, I wasn't a blackout drinker until then. It took a long time for that to happen for me. So instead of, you know, like my doctor would see some changes in my labs and she'd say, how much are you drinking? I'd say, well, I'm a couple a day. Well, I only want you to have five a week. And I'm thinking, God, I have that by 8 o'clock at night, you know, every night I'm having, you know, and I'm just pouring. And, you know, the rare times that I would run out of alcohol, I might find like little bottles of some nasty something in my house, and I would go and I'd like just hold my nose and I'd down it, and I had to have it. You know, I could be sick as a dog and I'd mix it as a hot toddy because it was medicinal then, you know. And but I couldn't go. I didn't go for a day. The only time I went without alcohol was the 2 9 months of my pregnancy. And then one time a therapist said to me, someday we're going to talk about your drinking. And I'm like, oh my God, he thinks there's something wrong with me. So I went home on a Monday and I said, okay, I'm going to just be a weekend drinker now. I'm going to show him. So I didn't drink like Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, because Friday's the weekend. And and then I went back to him the next week and I said, just so you know, I only drink on weekends now. You know, I mean, I went for 3 days without alcohol and it was like torture. But I had to tell him because I felt like I'd been busted. Like somebody knows now about my alcoholism. And then we never talked about alcohol. I went to this therapist. He was snowed. I mean, he had no clue like what I was really doing. I quit telling him about the 3 a.m. phone calls and the, you know, the stupid stuff that I was doing when I was drunk. And I just thought, I just won't tell him. So I quit. Like, I only drink on weekends. Well, of course, that following Monday, I'm drinking every day. I can't not drink. So I, you know, it just, I'm trying to hide it from him. It's escalating. I'm drinking now how I want to because my kids are gone. I'm home alone. I'm just like, oh my God, I'm pouring and I'm drinking. I'm like, what's wrong with me? I don't even want this. I don't even want the alcohol. I can't help myself. It's going to be different tomorrow. It's going to be different. I'm only going to have two, you know, and I never thought about not drinking because that's not a solution for me. I have to drink every day. So but every day I'd be like pouring and drinking, going, what's wrong, you know? And then after about the 10th drink, I'm like, okay, I don't know, I'll try again tomorrow. And I did this for the last couple years of my drinking. And then God entered my life and said, in his or her way, that intuitive thought came to me as I'm standing out at my pool, if you don't do something about your drinking, you're going to kill yourself or somebody else. Because I was driving drunk again, because I divorced my designated driver, you know, and so what do? You know, I'm driving in blackouts. I had never done that. I'm telling my kids, you have a designated driver, right? Like, you can't go anywhere unless you have the designated driver. And I am drunk driving on a regular basis again, you know, and I'm in my 50s, and it's just not pretty, and it's not going, it's going to end badly. And so this intuitive thought says, if you don't do something about your drinking, you're going to kill yourself or somebody else. And I listened to that voice. I mean, I realized I'm depressed. I am suicidal thoughts. I am back to church. I'm reading self-help books. I'm going to Buddhist temples. I'm trying everything to fix what's wrong with me. I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm flatlined emotionally. I'm like dead, you know, and for like about 3 years, I felt like that. And I didn't know it was my alcoholism. I just thought, I'm depressed. I'm calling friends. You think I need to be on antidepressants? What's wrong with me? You know, I'm going back to church. I'm not really praying because I don't know how to pray. But I'm going drunk to Buddhist temples. That was a little fun. You know, I'm meditating. That was, and they're probably like, oh my God, who has entered our rooms here, you know? But I was desperate for a solution and I didn't know what was wrong with me. So how can you find a solution if you don't know what's wrong with you? So when I got that intuitive thought that said, I'm gonna kill somebody or which was imminent, that Monday morning I went to work and I Googled Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I've never ever done that. I've never looked into AA. I don't have any family members. I have a lot of drunk relatives, but I didn't know anything about AA other than there are 12 steps. It's a religious cult, but it seems to work, you know? And I thought, okay, you know, I was ready to, I didn't want to live, and I couldn't imagine life without alcohol. So it took me about 3 days of kind of like, you know, hiding. Like as soon as somebody walked by, I'd like click, you know, minimize the alcoholics. If anybody would have walked in, I would have been mortified, you know, that I was looking at AA. So it took about 3 days and I'm looking and I'm starting to identify already. I mean, I'm reading like the doctor's opinion and it's talking about the craving and the inability, like once you put it in your body, you can't stop. And I'm like, oh my God, that's me. And so over these 3 days, I'm like, I think I'm an alcoholic. And it was so clear to me that that was my problem. Now, I didn't know what the solution was going to be, but I knew it had to, at least I had to go to AA. So I carried, I wrote down the central office number and I said, well, I'm gonna call them. You know, so a Wednesday night, I call them. And they go, well, yeah, there's a meeting right in your neighborhood. And I'm like, oh, I'm not in crisis mode. You know, I don't have to go like tonight, you know. So, and that was July 9th, or July 14th of 2010. And July 15th of 2010, I came home from work. I threw away all my alcohol. I was a daily pot smoker, too. I left that out. I threw that away. I said, if I'm doing sobriety, I'm doing this all the way. Told one of my kids who was home, I think I'm an alcoholic. He's like, really? And I said, yeah. He says, I'll support you no matter what. You know, and this is somebody that lived with me. Like, I could hide it really well. He didn't remember the times, all the times that I was blackout talking to him. Because the next day I'd say, you know, oh, let me tell you what happened. He goes, yeah, we had that whole conversation last night. And I said, no, we didn't. He's like, no, really, we did. And so I quit talking to him. You know, I was like, you know, I don't want to get caught. You know, that was so afraid of getting caught. You know, one of my next door neighbors said, yeah, you know, after I got in the program, he said, yeah, I noticed that the consumption of alcohol was like the bottles, because I bought, you know, by the time I was done, I was buying the big handles of gin, you know, the just the big stuff, you know. And so the trash can's filling up, and he said, I kind of wondered if I should say something to you. And I said, well, you could. But what I would have done is I would have just used two different trash cans, or I would have taken it to work, or I would have done something with it, but that wouldn't have helped, you know, because it's really not until we're really ready to do this thing does it work. And I was really ready to do it. So the next day I found a meeting in my neighborhood. I'm a little lazy, so I like to go close. It's a mile down my house. It's a Fifth Tradition group. Now, I started smoking about 2 years before I got sober. Started smoking again. I had quit when I found out I was pregnant. I quit for 20 years. And then all of a sudden, I'm drinking and smoking, and oh, just life's good. I'm like, I swear to God, I'm trying to kill myself with cigarettes because I am a chain smoker. And I'm like, well, I'm too, because I would look at my wrists and think, this is the way I really want to take myself out, but I'm a chicken and I can't do that. So I'll just smoke and drink myself to death, you know? It's like really slow, painful death, you know? Ugh. It wasn't working. So anyway, so I go to my first AA meeting. This is how little I know about AA. I left my cigarettes at home, you know, like I didn't know y'all smoked, you know. It was hysterical because I'm like watching all these people smoking and I'm like, oh my God, I want a cigarette. But I walked to my first meeting and I met a man in the parking lot, John Shire. Some of you probably know John. And he's just jovial and welcoming, and I'm like, I have no idea. I'm expecting the trench coats and the, you know, the old man. And I had no idea what I was going to find at all in AA. But I was so desperate. I thought I'd be willing to do anything and just to not drink. That's all. I just didn't want to drink. I didn't want to feel so terrible anymore. And so I, John comes up and says, hey, what meetings do you go to? And I'm like, and he goes, are you new? I'm like, yeah, is this your first meeting like ever? And he like hit the jackpot, you know. And I said, yeah, it is. Oh, and he brought me down. I'll never forget. We go down this hill. And he said, ladies, come on over here. We got like a new fresh one here. And, you know, they all surrounded me. And this was, our meeting was smaller back then. It was in, you know, 4 years ago almost. And I just remember I started crying. And all these women came around. And some of them are sitting right here in the room today. And you know, I don't know how I knew, but I felt like I knew it was going to be okay. And it sounds like so corny, but it was like I felt safe and I felt loved. And I thought, these people just, I didn't even have to talk to them. They just came and surrounded me and I felt it. I mean, if that's not a God thing, I don't know what is. You know, first of all, it brought me to this is my first meeting ever after, you know, years of being desperate. And I still have the numbers from that day and keep in touch with a lot of women. And I went to my first meeting. And they said, you know, so I sat there and they said, don't share in your first 90 days. And I'm like, oh, I got so much to say. You know, I'm on this spiritual journey. And I think they were on, I don't know what part of the book. It was the beginning of the book. It was a big book study. And but I was glad they told me just to keep my mouth shut because I really had no clue about God or spirituality or anything then. And they said, go get a white chip. And I'm like, well, what is that? I don't even know what a white chip is. Just go do it. And I said, okay. You know, I'm crying and picking up a white chip. And that was my first venture into Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, it was the Roundup weekend. And they said, now make sure you go. We're not, most of us are going to be at the Roundup. But you go to your meetings. And I said, okay, you know. So the next meeting I went to, not one person said hello to me. I was the only woman in the meeting. It was like such a different experience from my first one. Thank God that was my second meeting and not my first meeting. And I was talking to William earlier and I said, it's so important. You never know like when you're gonna be the first hand that's reaching out to somebody. And if I wouldn't have had those hands reaching out to me, I probably wouldn't be standing here. I'm pretty convinced. I would have said, I'm not really an alcoholic. I can't relate to any of these people. But there was a lot of young people. In fact, I felt super old at this meeting. I'm like, God, I'm ancient. You know, they're all like 20s and 30s and 40s, and I'm like nowhere near there. And but I felt loved and I felt welcome. So I just kept, and then the first meetings were so interesting. Thank God, you know, I kept going back, and I ended up in a short order, about 2 weeks it took me to get my sponsor, because I thought, okay, they kept saying, go to meetings, get a sponsor. So my sponsor, I didn't know it at the time, sold me my first big book that night, my first night. He said, I'll be your sponsor. And I'm like, great, but I don't know what that is, you know? And I mean, I was like really new. But I listened. My ears were so open. I was so ready to hear some kind of message. So about 2 weeks later, I got the courage to ask her to be my sponsor and just dove in and started doing service work. And the nice thing about our home group is we have, you know, we're always making coffee and setting up chairs and taking meetings places and greeting and doing all that. And I just jumped in. I said, I'll do whatever, you know. And then we started going through the book. And, you know, the way she did it is we met once a week and we just started reading from the very beginning, that blank page that says you don't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, which was very true in my case. And we went through weekly and read through the book, and that's how we worked the steps. And in the very beginning, she said, I want you to read 86 to 88. And I thought, I look it up, and it's like, that's step 11. Isn't that kind of jumping ahead a little bit? You know, seems a little excessive, but if you want me to, I'll do that. And to this day, I read 84 to 88, but I read it every morning still, you know, and there's a few reasons for it. One is it reminds me every day that I'm an alcoholic, and I cannot stray far from this program. If I'm sitting at a restaurant and a pretty drink walks by, my arm wants to go like this and grab it. I mean, it still happens. I don't want to drink, but that's how I am wired. If I'm not doing this thing on a regular basis, I'm going to drink. And I am so convinced that I don't have another chance. I feel like I have been given this gift on a platinum platter. And God said, here, and it would be a big screw you, God, if I don't continue to do what I do on a regular basis. So we started doing the steps. I knew I was powerless. Those words had come to me already as I'm pouring drinks down. I am powerless over this. I did not realize that was the first step. My life unmanageable part took me a minute. I had my job. I still have the same job I had then. I'm living in the same house, you know, but I can tell you from the inside, it feels so different than it did then. I was so sick every day. I could work with really horrific hangovers. I don't know, I was really good at that. You know, and that's what I thought sobriety was going to be. It was just going to be feeling better. It was just going to be not being hungover. And everything else is going to be miserable. And, but God, these people seemed happy. It was like, God, what, you know, and I'm like a basket case. The fears, now I have nothing to drown my life, like, out. You know, the voices and the anxiety and the fears now are just untreated. And so those first few months were pretty, they weren't comfortable. They kept saying, just keep working through the book with your sponsor. And once you start getting through some of these steps, you'll probably start feeling some relief. So one and two, okay, I believe in God. I've had divine intervention stuff happen. I've always felt like I've had little angels. You know, I feel like I've always had some kind of connection to something, but I've never really related to that, whatever that was. I mean, when I had like a little spiritual experience when I was about 14, and it was very clear, and I was walking the beach, and it was me and God, and we were connected. It's about the same time I found drugs and alcohol, and I turned my back and walked away, and I never looked back. So now here I am, and I'm like, okay, well, that's kind of embedded in me. Like, I believe there's something bigger than me. So that wasn't a big hurdle for me. So step three is something I still, you know, I have to do on a daily basis, sometimes on an hourly basis. I'm truly believe there's something bigger than me and that I just need to hand myself over, but I am so resistant to do that a lot of times, you know. So I have to do it every day. You know, the fourth step for me was... I was raw. I remember I was laughing earlier, you know, I was so fragile when I came in. I'm in my 50s and I've raised kids and you'd think I'd have some kind of strength. And my sponsor, she gets a sponsee and I fall apart. Like, oh God, you're not going to love me and this is just terrible. And it's just like, I was just a mess. And that's kind of how I look without drinking, you know, and it's like, it was, oh God, now I look back and I'm like, God, you were such, like, I came into the rooms at about age 4 and now I have 4 years. I think I've grown probably exponentially a little bit. And so I give myself about a 13 right now, you know, maybe on a good day, 18. But other than that, you know, it's like, I came in so fragile and just so scared and I didn't even know it. I didn't even know I was living in that amount of fear. So we do four, and the resentments were like I had them, you know, absolutely from years back, but the fears were probably when I did my fear inventory. That's probably where I start feeling most of my relief, you know, because I didn't realize that from the moment I woke up, I was afraid. Nobody's gonna like me. I'm gonna die alone. I remember I used to have like, oh God, my phone hasn't. I could be dead in my house. Phone hasn't rung in days, and I'm going to be rotting here before anybody even misses me. You know, those are kind of my thoughts. Or I'd walk outside every morning. I did this every morning for, like, years. And I have to peer around. Like, there's, like, people in the bushes, you know. It was like they're waiting to pounce. And that was the amount of fear. I lived in that kind of fear. I'm not going to have enough money. I'm not going to have it. I mean, everything, constant. So my fear inventory was, like, huge. I mean, it was pages of fear inventory. But as I went through it with my sponsor, I started feeling like I wasn't so crazy. I started getting some kind of relief. And then the sex inventory was interesting because, like, oh God, all those one-night stands were kind of haunting. But, you know, got through that and did my fifth step and then six and seven. And it's six and seven so interesting. I'm kind of realizing these defects are just going to keep coming back around, you know, and they're less now, and I'm kind of aware of them a little bit more now than I was. In the beginning for sure, but you know, most those are my defense mechanisms to how to live my life. And you know, once you took my alcohol away, it was like, oh God, because I would just drown every night, and I had this hole and I filled it every day, and now I have this hole and it's like, God, now what do I put into it? Well, I'm starting to pray a little bit and starting to get a little bit of relief there. And then I just kept moving forward with the steps. So we did the steps within probably 6 months. I was sponsoring somebody. But the eighth, my amends were, you know, there's a couple that stand out. One is I had this one teacher that I hated this woman. I worked with her. I made her life miserable. I'm now a nurse in a school. And, I mean, she was so afraid of me. And And when we did the four columns, you know, like who you're willing to make your amends, I'm like, she is on my not will. I'm not ever, ever going to make amends to her. Never, ever. And Melissa's like, just pray for the willingness, you know. And I'm like, mm-mm, I'm not. And so I start making amends to, you know, the easier ones, you know, my kids. And of course, they don't want to hear it. And I have to say, no. I know I have done harm. You know, and my boss, the principal at my school, because I created a lot of havoc in the school. I was just not easy to get along with. And he actually wrote me a note and said, that must have taken a lot of courage to make this amends. And, you know, I appreciate what you're doing. And good luck to you, you know. And I did a financial amends. I had used to steal money from the cash register of a place I worked. And I had to go back and do that one. And oh my God, I had to pray to have the willingness to do that. But this one person, I was just not going to do it. But after doing a few amends, like she was probably about number 9. And one day I woke up and that intuitive thought, if you get them, listen to them. Because it said, you can make your amends to her. So I get in touch with her. She gets in touch with the principal and says, is it safe for me to meet with her? She was so afraid of me. I mean, I was not nice to her at all. So we met, and it was one of probably the most powerful amends I had, you know, so you never know. Like, you would think it would be family or something. It was just one that I wasn't going to do, didn't think it mattered. I was, you know. And that one probably gave me more relief than a lot of the other ones I did. I don't know if it was because I wasn't willing to do it or I'm not really sure why, but I absolutely, that was a powerful amends for me. My ex-husband, I had done an amends early on, and about a year later I realized I didn't really do an amends with him, not really. Like, I didn't really see the harm and how, like, I didn't think I did anything wrong. Like, how can you be married 20 years and never do anything wrong? I mean, I really thought it was all his fault. And through the program, I've learned, I did a lot of things in that marriage that were selfish and self-centered, so I went about a year later. I did a proper amends to him. I was thorough as I could be with my amends. I mean, I made amends that one sexual assault. I got pregnant and I had an abortion. I'm doing my amends and it was like, oh my God, I need to do an amends to the baby. You know, the potential of life. Like, it was. It just came, like I wanted a clean slate. I wanted to make sure that I had done everything that I could to start a new life. And 10, 11, and 12, like 11 I had been doing from the beginning, and I still do it every day, and it's something every day. I wake up and I read 10 and 11, and it's like, you are an alcoholic, and I have to remind myself that every day. And I also have to remind myself that I have something that's much bigger than me, a higher power that I, on a daily basis, make a better contact with. And I do it in a lot of different ways. You know, I don't get on my knees and pray. I pray, I sit. I don't like knees. It's just not my way to do it, but however you do it. I do meditation. I've incorporated that into my everyday life. I do a lot of reading. I do, you know, I pray now during the day. In the beginning, it was like, God, just help me stay sober today. And then about 2 months into the program, I got that intuitive thought that said, like, I thought about quitting smoking cigarettes early on. And everybody says, don't make any big decisions for a year. You know, do your steps, you know, wait a year. And I said, no, I really got to quit, you know. So I set a date in my mind, and then I had a full-blown panic attack just thinking about quitting. I'm, like, smoking a cigarette, and I'm, like, freaking out. Like, oh, my God, I'm never going to be able to quit. I'm never going to be able to quit. About a week later, and then Melissa's just like, well, just pray for the willingness, you know, and so I'm like, just let me know when it's my time to quit, and I'll be damned if, like, a week later, I don't get this intuitive thought that says, you can quit tomorrow. Really? Tomorrow? Like, I just had a panic attack tomorrow, and I count, I got 7 cigarettes, and I'm like, okay, that'll get me through the night, you know, and I quit September 23rd of 2010, and I will be honest here, if one had to pick up a white chip, I was in England in October, and they had clove cigarettes, which I loved, and I thought, I can smoke cloves because they're not really cigarettes. It's kind of like drinking a non-alcoholic beer, I think, which wouldn't count either because there's really alcohol in there, and there's nicotine in there. So I carried this package around with me all day, and it was like going to be a ceremony. I was just, I'm in Oxford, England, and I'm going to have this cigarette. I know I'm off the subject, this isn't alcohol, but I'm going to tell it anyway. So I sit down at this beautiful bench, and I light this cigarette, and I'm like, oh my God, this is terrible. I have a feeling I wouldn't do that with a drink, but I put it out and I didn't have it. My son said, you have to pick up a white chip for that. I said, no, thank God. So my honest sobriety date is probably that day, but you know, when it comes to cigarettes. But so I use the steps early on. So every morning I say, God, keep me free of alcohol and nicotine. And that worked for me, but it was really the alcohol. At the end of the day, I'd say, thank you for keeping me sober. And it's taken time to learn kind of how to pray during the day. Like my go-to now, if I'm going in to have words with somebody at work or have to deal with somebody, I pray, give me the guidance, give me the right words, show me the truth, what, you know, help me through this. And I find that over time, this has become kind of a normal occurrence. I mean, it says, you know, one of the lines in the book, having just made conscious contact with God, you know, we're new at this, and so it's an evolution, and that's my spiritual life has been an evolution, just as you know, it's slow, and you just keep plugging away at it, and it seems to just kind of work. But I can't stray far at all. And 12 is you know, the one that says will work better than anything. And in the beginning, I'm like, God, I hear all these people saying how great this is. And I'm, you know, it's like, it seems kind of time consuming and it's a little inconvenient and, you know, it's scary. The first person, I was 6 months sober and somebody asked me to, well, I had one sponsee who was new. And then right after that, I had somebody who had 16 years of sobriety. I have 6 months and I'm in a panic. Melissa, what do I do? You know, she goes, you take them through the book just like you do anybody else. And that's what I did with her. And that's what I do. So I sponsor women, and I don't say no. And I thought I could do one or two, and there's been times I've had several more than that, and there's always been time to do that for some reason. You know, and I've learned so much, and I love going through the book. And every time I go through it, I see something new, and it's just developed really beautiful relationships with women, and it's been what a blessing. So, you know, I came into this program just to quit drinking. That's all I wanted. Just help me not have to drink every day. I thought maybe even, I didn't even know if down the road I thought I could maybe learn how to drink one or two. I wasn't even thinking that clearly. I just knew that I had to stop pretty quickly, you know, or I was going to die. And, you know, what I've gotten is a family. Like this is, like I remember about 6 months sober, I looked around my home group and I went, oh my God, this is my family now. Like it's this huge extended family that is, like, where do you get that, you know? And you can talk about, like, heavy, deep spiritual things. And there's not many places that there's a freedom to do that. You know, it's been such a blessing, you know, for me. So, you know, that's my life today is, it's a lot AA. You know, I go to my home group meetings 3 days a week, Tuesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays. Sponsor a lot of women, and then I have, you know, I have my outside life, and I've found that my outside life is my work life. Like I don't have to make amends all the time at work now, you know. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not, people aren't afraid of me at work. Like I'm not wreaking havoc and screaming at other employees. Wow, that's amazing, you know. It's like my life is so much easier just because of that. When I go to church, I have this strong, like I have been going to church, but now I actually have a connection with my church. That's a big part of my life now too. I do a lot of my service work there at church, and I do a lot of service work in AA, and I have, you know, really good relationship with my kids, my family, my ex-husband. He maybe overdid it a little bit this year. It's usually just Thanksgiving. This year was Thanksgiving, Christmas Eve, New Year's, and something else. There was like 4 all in a row. Okay, God, you're really testing me here, but we did okay, you know. But so we have a decent relationship, and I never thought that would happen. And, you know, it's like, if you just come in and do it, it's so simple. It really is. Like, I was so petrified when I came in and so full of fear and just did not think there was ever, I could ever survive more than 4 days without a drink. And now it's going on 4 years and it's a miracle. I mean, it doesn't mean that there's not days that, I had a Christmas day. My kids came in with, good God, they came in with beer, eggnog, rum, wine, like a big thing. And it was like, you know, because there's alcohol in my house. I have parties at my house where there's alcohol. I can be around alcohol. But I always have to pray when I'm, you know, I always pray, like, God, keep me safe and protected here, no matter what, wherever. Because I just, my go-to is going to be to grab that drink. Kids walk in on Christmas Day, and I'm like, oh, God, that looks good. You know, I could probably have a drink with them. You know, it's Christmas. And that thought scared me so much, and it wouldn't go away. You know, it was just like, where did this, you know, like I was struck with it. It was very frightening, and I went into the bathroom. I say I don't pray on my knees. I prayed on my knees that day. I closed the bathroom door, and I got on my knees, and I prayed and said, God, you got to help me here. This is really, really scaring me. I don't know if I was close to a drink or not, but it was like a test, and it's came out of the bathroom, and I was okay, and all that liquor stayed in my house for the whole holiday season, and I never once wanted it again, you know. But if I don't stay close and have some kind of insurance program with my higher power, I could pick up a drink like that, you know. So anyway, it's been a pleasure to, it's hard to believe an hour's almost gone by. It's been nice being here, and thank you for having me.